Okay, it's the 3rd of March, and we're discussing Ellen DeGeneres' selfie at the Oscars. And so we have copyright, and so what would, you're right, the rights of publicity have to do? How might they come up? Any use?
In commercials.
So, to the extent that someone wanted to commercialize on this image, he or she might have to get the permission of whomever was in the photo. Okay. I think there were a couple of selfies, or maybe so. Okay, so maybe it's Brad Cooper. Now that raises a very interesting question. That, in fact, complicates the matter a bit further. Because is there any other possibility besides Bradley Cooper? Well, let's focus on Ellen DeGeneres. Yes, we're talking about the Oscars, but a licensing point. Is there any other person, entity, party who might own Ellen DeGeneres' selfie, assuming it was Ellen who took it?
The hiring party, whoever hired to host the show.
Yeah. She was not there for the hell of it, right? This was not walking down past wherever they have the Oscars. No, she was the hostess or host. She was hired to be there and to entertain. And how would we know? Well, okay, so she was hired. Does that mean automatically that the producers of the award show or the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences own Ellen's selfie? What do you think? Why not? Why does it have to be in the scope of the agreement? She worked for them.
Because it has to be the tasks that were reasonably associated with her assignment or her employment.
You're close. But it's not quite, because you're thinking of it in the context of an employee. But what?
I'm thinking maybe it wasn't during the Oscars, it was before.
It was during.
Oh,
it was actually right there in the middle. But does Ellen work for the Academy as an employee for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences? Right? She's an independent contractor, most likely. And as an independent contractor, no, I think that's her arm taking it. It's just that guy is. Oh, did he? Anyway. So, I guess that's the famous selfie. So she's a contractor, which means what? With regard to the claim of the producer of the show to the intellectual property, the copyright she creates during the show. Own or not own? Why?
Well, I mean, she's an independent contractor. Again, whatever she was hired to do would be that of the employer, but the Academy.
No. No. Not when it comes to copyright. What needs to happen in order for an independent contractor's copyright to be owned by the contracting party? How does that transfer need to happen? Because it's not automatic, right? She's not an employee. No, that's patent. It's not a work made for hire. That would be if she's an employee. How do you turn what a contractor does into the equivalent of a work made for hire? What has to happen? Remember the definition of work?
There was a certain amount of control.
No. Again. What? Yes, except there's a really important something else that has to happen. What is that? 17 USC. Is it
102.
Is the work made for hire definition? Not 107, it might be 106. Where's my work made for hire?
107
is variables. Yep. 101. 101 there, okay. So it is in the definitions. All right. So let's see. A work made for hire is, come on, scroll it down. There. Okay, let's see. A work prepared by an employee within the scope of his or her employment, or a work specially ordered or commissioned, blah, 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 if. Read like lawyers. If all of these are conditioned on what comes after the if. And what comes after the if? If the parties expressly agree in a written instrument signed by them that the work shall be considered a work made for hire. So the answer to our question is, we don't know the answer to the question, but we know where to look. We know where to look. We look at Ellen's contract with the producers of the show. And if it included in its terms that any intellectual property created by Ellen DeGeneres during the course of the Oscar broadcast shall be deemed a work made for hire, then yeah, it's the producers who own the copyright to the work. And if it doesn't say that or the equivalent, then it's Ellen or Bradley Cooper or whomever would be the whoever took the photo who owns the work.
That they're gonna contemplate that next time.
I suspect they contemplated it this time. I mean, they may not have thought about selfies. On the other hand, since Samsung was handing out phones to everybody and their neighbor. Although I did read that some of the backstage photos that Ellen was posting were taken with her iPhone, even though Samsung was a big sponsor. But, and even if not, right, even if you're not talking about photographs, there's a lot of, well, in theory, a lot of ad-libbing that might go on. And the producers have to be able to rebroadcast, have to be able to do all those things. I'm fairly confident that her deal assigned that intellectual property to them, not just the photos, but I would suspect it includes all copyrighted works created by her in the course of that broadcast. Wouldn't you think? They're not unintelligent, unsophisticated lawyers doing the Oscars. So I would bet that while Ellen or Bradley Cooper might have taken it, that's why it makes a difference whose hand was on the camera. Because if it was Ellen's hand, it's entirely likely that who owns it? The producers of the show. But Bradley Cooper, was he a presenter or anything, or he was just there? I don't know anything. I wouldn't watch the show. But assuming he was just a guest or an awardee or something, if he's holding the camera, he owns the photo. Not the producers. So it's really important to the extent that there is any use of that picture to determine which hand was on the camera. Looks like Bradley Cooper to me, just from the angle, but
it was in her Twitter that she said that.
Alright, well then he owns it and she doesn't, and neither do the producers, perhaps. There was one other licensing issue related to this. essence, did Ellen well?
It's interesting.
All those tweets, right? Who gave the other people the right to distribute on Twitter? What? Ellen told them to. But if she doesn't own the picture, nobody but our classroom is thinking about this. I guarantee it. But if she doesn't hold the copyright, and the producers don't hold the copyright, does she have the right to authorize people to redistribute via Twitter?
Wouldn't that depend on how she got possession of the photo?
No.
Bradley Cooper sent it to her and it was his phone. And
right.
Then maybe it's implied he gave her a license.
Would it depend on the user licensing agreement with Twitter?
Well, that's as between the person who posted and Twitter, but if she says, okay, everybody go retweet this. We want to see if we can break the record for retweets. That's everyone go redistribute this copyrighted work. These are not things that anybody's going to deal with. But it's a really, actually, damn it, it's a good exam question. I have to remember that. Got that? Exam question. On the web, no. Very specifically, if you post something on a website, right? Because websites work by sending out copies, local copies. There's an implied license to make the local copy to view the website.
So you don't think Twitter has that in their user agreement that by
it may well be, right? But did Ellen? Who has the right? Bradley Cooper takes the picture, hands the phone to Ellen.
Are we assuming it's her phone or his phone?
I don't know. Again, great exam question. Really interesting exam question. Really interesting legal question. Totally unrelated to the real world, which is why it's a great question for a law school. Because nobody's going to ask this, but what if someone wants to make a t-shirt? Another great exam question. Damn it. Yeah.
So it's not cut and dry. He took the picture. It's his property. But what if it's her phone and she's telling him to take the picture? None of that matters. If he took the picture, it's his property.
Let's go back to section 10, our definition. What if she's telling him to take the picture with her phone? What does that make him? It makes him nothing legally. Doesn't matter whose phone it is. Right? If you hand an artist your paint box, or you hand a great photographer your camera, and the great photographer takes a great picture with your camera, who holds the copyright? The artist. The materials don't matter. And let's say she said to him, could you take a picture for me? What importance does that have in copyright? Based on what we see here.
No.
Why? You're correct. Why?
I got 50% of the question right here.
No. Because I've already answered the question.
Right.
I walked over and pointed to it.
Right.
Why does her telling him to take a picture not have any legal impact for copyright?
Because he's just there assuming he wasn't a part of the Oscars? He's just
no. As between Ellen and Bradley.
Right.
Okay? He's the artist. She's asked him to create art for her. Why doesn't that transfer copyright to her? I see your hand, but we're going to go with this. No. Look, it doesn't matter who did it. What did I point to after the if? If you can't read it, we'll make it even bigger. Hold on. It's right there. What does it say after the if? Can you see it?
If the parties expressly agree. Wait.
Yes, I'm sorry, I just lost it. Sorry, hold on. Where did it go? There it is. Okay, here it is. If the parties expressly agree, keep going.
In a written instrument signed by them that the work shall be considered a work made for hire.
Right. What is required under the law for Ellen to own the picture that Brad Cooper took for her? No, you just read it out loud. If, what happens?
If the parties expressly agree, in a written instrument.
In a written instrument.
Right.
Signed by both parties. So if Ellen had handed her picture, her photo, her phone to Brad Cooper and said, hey Brad, would you please take this for me and would you sign this as signing over the copyright to me? And he had done both, then yes. As between Ellen and Brad, there would have been a transfer. Now, of course, if Ellen had also signed an agreement with the producers, once she got possession of the copyright, it might automatically, by virtue of that other contract, transfer to the producers. But did the if happen here?
Nope.
So, assuming Brad Cooper was holding the camera, even if it belonged to Ellen or Samsung or the producers, if Brad Cooper were not also contracted to perform at the award ceremony, who owns this copyright in the selfie?
Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper. And nobody on the internet is saying that. Or maybe they are, if they've thought through this analysis. But see, this is what we do. This is what we do. You look at the facts and you say, let's trace this. Who took the picture? That's why it matters whose hand was on the camera. It's, if you said to anybody else, whose picture? It's Ellen's selfie. Who, you know, she said so. She tweeted it out. But no, this is like Columbo or, you know, some of, excuse me, but whose hand was on that camera at the time, right? It matters. You have no idea what I'm talking about. Look it up. 70s TV. It's even early, older, old for me, right? Look it up. Look up Columbo sometime. They did movies in the 80s, too. I know you're all too young. Look it up. Great classic TV. But, right, or CSI, or, you know, Quirky Detective Series number 16 this week, right? Where there's that one little fact, Bones, except they'll all be dead people. My daughter loves Bones. Yeah, well, there are no spaceships. There's nobody with capes. I don't watch it. So, yes, I really am that deep. Yeah?
I'll give you one more level. Assuming if she did,
good question.
So she might not own the, could that affect the ownership of it?
And who owns the fake Idina Menzel Twitter handle that somebody created once John Travolta mispronounced her name? Which was like, I don't know what he said, but within seconds someone created a Twitter account with that name and started doing mispronounced versions of Idina Menzel's existing tweets. It was very fun. So, whether that, yeah, the ownership of, that's not, ownership of the Twitter account is one thing. Ownership of any copyrighted works created through that account, to the extent that a tweet by itself can establish copyright, is a totally different question and one I'm happy to talk about, but not today. So, that is...
Does it matter also if you take the picture just through your regular camera or through the Twitter application?
Does it? What do you think? It might for the purposes of the license to Twitter. If you, like Instagram, if you use Instagram, although what is happening behind the scenes. Is it actually using the app to take the picture, or is the app simply accessing the software already on the phone? We're not even getting into that, because that doesn't establish copyright ownership. Copyright ownership comes from the artist, the creator, his employer or her employer, or through a written agreement. So that is Oscar-related licensing question number one. Here is Oscar-related licensing question number two. And it actually is relevant. I am looking for what it is on my phone. Where are we? Here we go. Where are you? Oh, there. Scrollity, scroll, scroll. Come on, where are you? Where are you? I know you're here. There it is. Oscar-related licensing question number two. You ready? Oscar-winning song, right? Quick question. What's missing? This is the instrumental karaoke version on the Frozen soundtrack deluxe edition, track 55 of 59. So here's my question for you, licensing question. You have all of these Frozen adaptations and spoofs and parodies on YouTube, and if anyone wants to see my lyrics, The Ballad of the Frozen Parent, of someone who's tired of all of them, I can share them with you. But I was inspired this weekend. But here's my question. Is it legal for all of these people to use what I just played, which is the actual soundtrack music, not just the composition, but the actual recording in YouTube, not even as a parody. If it's a parody, there are parody exceptions. But is it legal for someone to sing the song and post it online using that as the backing track? What do you think? What do you think? Why not?
That would be a derivative work.
It would be a derivative work. Someone make a lawyer argument on the other side.
Well, they labeled it karaoke.
They labeled it karaoke. Right? This is not someone stripped out the vocals using a piece of software. Or brought you used a mixer and brought down the vocals as far as you can hear that sometime when people are doing parody songs. And you can very quietly hear the real vocals because they brought down the center track. No, no. This is Disney releasing a karaoke version on its soundtrack, labeled as instrumental karaoke version. So make the argument. You're right, as a default, they own it, you know, the composers who won the Oscar last night, and then maybe they assign their rights, whatever. The musicians, that particular recording, and if you watch on YouTube, you can see them actually record it, which is kind of cool. But make the argument.
By purchasing either the soundtrack or maybe on iTunes, just that individual karaoke version, granted a sub-license to use.
Is there an explicit sub-license? Does it say that?
Maybe not if you bought it online.
I have it here.
I don't know if this CD comes with a packet.
If it doesn't, does that mean there's no license?
I would say there's an implied license.
I think you could really argue there's an implied license. I think that if a copyright holder distributes to the public a karaoke version of a song labeled as such, I think there's a strong argument that there is an implied license, at which point you start arguing, what's the scope of the implied license? Well, it might, like I say, she's right. In the, if I started playing on my stadium speakers without a license, the actual recording, right, with Idina Menzel, yeah, that's public performance. But if I were in that stadium and decided I really wanted to humiliate myself in front of thousands, I mean, I did that, and I started playing the karaoke version and sang it out, it's a karaoke version. And I think by labeling it and distributing it in what was at that point the best-selling album, right? It was number one in the charts for a couple of weeks anyway. I think Disney has granted an implied license to people to publicly perform it. Now, does that mean and post it on YouTube and do these other things? I don't know.
That's where my analogy was going. CDs are playing in a limited audience.
You are.
I was thinking the same with karaoke, you're like limited audience. You know, the same deal. You put on YouTube, you have this channel, get to
stage. But if you release it today, right, knowing full well what people do with songs, especially catchy Disney songs, is there an implied license? I think there is. I would argue that there is certainly a strong argument for it. And so, lawyer point, because we want to bring it back. When you're in-house counsel to Disney, we should only be so lucky because then you'll be donating money back to Toro. It would be a good thing. When you're in-house counsel to Disney, or whatever the analog is, and your client wants to release something in a form that suggests a use, just like posting it online creates an implied license to make a local copy, at least as long as it takes to view the web page. That doesn't mean you have that, because you now have a local copy, you are permitted to duplicate it and print it and do all those other things. Print it once, sure. But put it on a t-shirt and make derivative works? Probably not. That license is limited to the projected use. But your client needs to understand that by posting it or making it available in a certain form that implies a use, your client might also be deemed to have granted an implied license. And so I don't see, I would actually be very interested to know if, because if you go on YouTube, right, and you type in, what? I don't even want to know. You type this in. You find lots and lots and lots of, you have a parody. Mandy and Zoe sing Let It Go. There's a great mother singing it. Lexi Walker performs it. You know, there are 1,000 spoofs, Let It Go Korean version. You know.
So do you think instrumental alone gives that implied license, or the word karaoke?
I don't know, but I think karaoke certainly makes it. Oh, I don't want to watch Bruce Lee ad. Don't care. See? My wife loved this. Although I will say this inspired my song. Notice, this is not some re-perform.
The nightlight glows in the nursery tonight. Not a tantrum to be seen.
I'm not going to subject you to all of this.
The living room's a pigsty, and it looks like I need to clean. My kid was howling.
All right, already. Yes, moms everywhere love this particular, but notice what's in the background. It's not just her singing the song as a parody. You could say, for the lyrics, she's got parody rights, but that's the actual recording that I just played you. It's no question. How does she have the right to do that? She's not parodying the performance, right? She's not parodying the musician, she's parodying the lyrics. Was released as a karaoke.
Is the karaoke instrumental different from the, I guess, the actual instrumental? Because I know some places will switch it up with tones or...
Well, you might have people who release karaoke versions of things, and they've got to... If I mean, there are whole... I know we're not even getting into today's topic, which we will, but we have two classes. And I really think this is real-world important stuff. Never miss a teachable moment. So there are plenty of record labels. You go to Spotify, for example, and see all the karaoke versions of things in the style of, but all of those are re-recorded. They've licensed the composition, right? They've licensed the sheet music, the right to perform it from ASCAP or BMI or whomever. But they then hire musicians to record it and release it as karaoke. This, to the best that my ear can tell you, or can tell me, is exactly, it's basically like they used to say, music minus one, if you learned an instrument. I mean, this is, no, not that Demi Lovato version, we don't like that. This is the original. Right, so this is, wait, this is the song with the lyrics.
The snow glows white on the mountain tonight.
Right, okay. All right, so that's with the lyrics. And then, because it's the same recording, scroll, where are you? Phone does not want to behave itself. Oh, here we go. Anyway. Yeah.
So in essence, that would offer additional protection to the original.
Right. It's the same backing tracks. They just unmixed Idina. So what do you mean additional... Stop. Thank you. What do you mean by additional protection?
Because if you create a karaoke version and there's an implied license on the karaoke version...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Version. So if Disney had created a different instrumental, but...
Then they go after anybody who uses...
Right, although on the other hand, why would you bother? Right?
Well,
no, what I mean to say is, yes, if the second version on the album, the karaoke version, was not the same, but it wouldn't matter, right? Because from Disney's perspective, the issue is the karaoke, is the rights in that particular, whatever recording of the performance is, whether it's the one that backed Idina Menzel or backed Demi Lovato, or they re-recorded it for karaoke. Doesn't matter. The question is, do you have the right as the mom or your kids or whomever to use that, whatever one they release, on YouTube? And I think the answer is maybe. Because there is, by calling it karaoke and releasing it in this era, and it's not just karaoke. If it were released for a particular karaoke machine, software for a karaoke machine, or what is it, the Band Hero, or you know, what are those video games where you're singing along? What? Rock Band or whatever. There you might say, no, that's a license just for that particular use. But not this. It hadn't even occurred to me, but thinking about this, they call it karaoke. They release it.
I'm thinking, like, what is karaoke? And it's something that, like, normally you do.
Right.
But you wouldn't capture it on video normally. Like, maybe somebody in the
Would you say that today, though?
Yeah, but
implied license is all about what is reasonable for someone to assume the copyright holder knew would happen. Like I say, if they released it in Rock Band, that's one thing. They might not necessarily assume that you would video record your Rock Band performance and post it to YouTube. But if you release it as just an audio track today, I think you've got a really strong argument. So I do wonder whether Disney would send a takedown notice and what Google would do about it. Because it probably would be detected automatically. It's an interesting legal question. Okay. Any other thoughts about Academy Awards and intellectual property? Sure. Are they making more money? If karaoke company comes to you and is willing to pay you a license fee in addition to your sale of the original album, you're making now two sales, right? This is just included as one of 50 whatever tracks for the extra dollar you pay for, on, at least on Amazon, for the deluxe edition. So that's not any additional revenue. In fact, by doing this, as opposed to allowing the market to come to it, Disney is foregoing revenue. Because they're not charging, yeah, I guess in theory they could release it as their own track, but if they include it on an album, as they did, you're paying a lot less even than 99 cents for that track. As opposed to them being, they would certainly be approached. And then they could get licensing fees without having to do any of the distribution side from the karaoke publishers. And they wouldn't owe any money potentially to, I don't know if they owe royalties to the musicians or if they're all contract players, whatever. But, and that assumes that Disney holds the copyright in the composition, which it probably does, but. So I'm not sure if they would make more or less money doing it this way.
In that picture, there doesn't seem to be any...
We're talking about the selfie or mom?
Selfie.
Okay.
There doesn't seem to be any trademark logos or anything like that. If there were, say it was in out front on the red carpet and there was a banner with an advertisement on the back, how would that affect? Would that have any effect on anything?
You don't really expect me to answer that question, do you?
So we'd answer
together. Right, yeah. Nice try, however.
I'm assuming they...
Right?
Does their relationship with, I'm assuming, probably the vendor...
Samsung, if you could see it, right? This
right.
is a picture of the picture. What relevance does that have to copyright? someone wanted to use this image with the Samsung logo for an advertisement for something else. Samsung might have a trademark claim. You are using our trademark in it without our permission. Obviously, this is all about product placement. That's why they threw these phones at people. But so they have no, they would certainly have no trademark claim against the broadcasters, because that was the purpose of the exercise. But if, you know, I don't know who, the makers of these wonderful clothing, not that any of them is going to advertise, because none of them is off the rack, but, you know, tuxedo manufacturers, making photograph-worthy tuxedos since 1933. Here's the picture. Samsung might have a claim there. Say, look, we don't want to be associated with your ad campaign. Our mark should not be, because there's an implied affiliation. Just like, remember when we looked at the Total News framing thing, and the issue was not so much copyright as the implied relationship. So I think there, that the product placement of the visible logo might matter, but not for copyright purposes, potentially, though, for trademark purposes. Okay. Any other questions, thoughts, comments, attempts at distraction, as if I need help, all of the above. Okay. Let us begin the published topic for tonight's class. Having nothing to do with selfies, nothing to do really with copyright necessarily, although as I think we discussed a couple days ago when we talked about the Tech Transfer Conference, there is copyrighted works being created in academia as well, but that's not what we're going to focus on. What we're going to focus on is how universities keep the lights on. Research universities. Why is it that research universities research? Why is it that research universities research?
To facilitate the scientific community and further scientific development in the population generally.
Okay, that's true. Universities do. Why is it that the SUNY Research Foundation pays for people to research? I guess part of that is there.
Why is the SUNY Research Foundation created to manage intellectual property as an independent third party for SUNY's faculty members?
Okay. So what, they're there to manage the intellectual property. What does that mean? Does it mean that they, you know, they're the ones with the bookshelves? No. Well, we're getting to Bayh-Dole. It's not just about pure science, is it?
No, there's commercial endeavor.
Right. They're looking to make revenue. I heard someone say at a conference some years ago, I think he said at the time that the Columbia University global commercialization tech transfer was something on the order of $100 million a year. I don't know if that was the actual number. It was some staggering figure.
Royalty revenue that comes in?
Yeah.
Should be way more than.
Maybe it was a slow year. Whatever it was. These are big, you know, these are huge numbers for many universities. And if you really want to know, if you want to see it with your own eyes, look at the offices that English professors have versus the offices that biology professors and biochemists have and psychologists have, but especially the ones who are creating transferable technology. English faculty, English professors, they probably have some sort of quirky office decorations, But they don't tend to get huge grants unless one of them gets lucky and gets a MacArthur. Right? My wife was a grad student at Stony Brook, early 90s. Not every office had a phone. But the labs with the grants got the goods. That's where the money came from. They had the extra grad students. They had the phones. They had... This is big business. It's big business for the service of knowledge, yes. Universities aren't generally in the business of trade secrets. That's not what they're... They are in the business of publishing, but publishing at a profit. And how that happens, and how you take the interests of the inventors, the interests of the employers, and the interest of the sources of funding, public and private, and you mix them all together, turns out to be a really complicated and interesting thing that is not incidentally very, very relevant for this particular market for legal services. We are not only on a very long island with a 2 to 3 million person population, we have, I would say, far more than our share of world-class research facilities here on Long Island. We don't think about it. Not just Stony Brook, although absolutely Stony Brook. Brookhaven National Labs and Cold Spring Harbor Labs. Huge, huge sources of research and development and new technologies. Stony Brook has, let's see, a Center of Excellence in Wireless and Information Technology. There's an Energy Center. There's the Center for Biotechnology. Other schools here on the island have all these various centers. Brooklyn, I know that has certain centers. We are a research hub, a national and international research hub. And what that means is there's work for lawyers who get this stuff. There's work for lawyers at the university level in the tech transfer office. There's work for lawyers who are involved with venture capitalists investing and doing due diligence. There's work for lawyers working with entrepreneurs coming out of research labs and going out on their own. And so this is a really crucial topic for you, thinking about career opportunities in our region. So there are a lot of different areas clearly where these issues come together, but probably among the most fruitful here is biotechnology. When you're talking about biotechnology, no, I'm not going to make another 70s TV reference, but look it up, Bionic Man, etc. But you think about, okay, biotechnology. But what you're talking about is practical bioscience, applied biology, not just studying systems, but adapting them, changing them, implementing hybrids of biology and technology. Genome sequencing here on Long Island. CAT scans invented here. The MRI was invented here, right, on Long Island. All sorts of things coming out of practical bioscience, pharmaceuticals. Katie and they missed that one. Oops. Oops.
They turned that sucker down.
There would be two dice-shaped hospitals instead of one had they... See, this is why it pays to have people who know these things, who also have a good business sense. Ah, the MRI, it'll never catch on. We just use big flashlights. So, again, what are covered in biotech? Pharmaceuticals, which are not necessarily machines, but biotechnology to create them, biotechnology and how they work. Genomics. Sequencing the human genome, modifying it, and not only the human genome, obviously plants and animal genomes, biological inventions, genetically modified organisms, Cheerios, not GMO. They never were because oats aren't generally genetically modified, but they're getting good marketing at not being GMO. And then medical devices, true technology to assist and affect biology. And when you're talking about which IP regimes, which topics of intellectual property cover biotechnology, clearly patent is the big one. These are inventions, and even the life forms can sometimes be deemed as inventions. You have copyright too. How do you have copyright coming out of biotechnology? What kind of copyright do you think arises out of biotech? Anybody have any ideas?
Do you count like software?
I very much count software. Right? There you go. There you go. So what it was not so much the scanner. These were, I don't want to say off-the-shelf scanners, but they were existing scanners. But what we have with software was the ability to take the information coming from those scanners and turn it into usable form with the proper resolution and the proper manipulation in order to detect certain masses. That's software. That's protected. It can be protected by patent, but it can also be protected by copyright. And they're not exclusive. And then again, not so much necessarily university research covered by trade secrets, although it, but private research may well be covered by trade secret even absent anything else. And as we've discussed, sometimes that's because whether it's the timing issues in terms of how long it takes to get patent protection or the value being more in keeping others from knowing how you do something versus publication of a patent. So you... companies may elect to go the trade secret route. And just to give you a sense, what we have here, let's click that, there we go. At Stony Brook, but not really of Stony Brook, we have the Center for Biotechnology. This is not a school within Stony Brook. It is a Center for Advanced Technology funded by the state. There is some funding, I believe, from the Research Foundation.
Very little.
They do, you know, there are biotech courses, but this is a standalone center for helping commercialization, technology development, business development, workforce development. They have an incubator, they invest. They have corporate clients who help fund them and then get access to services and activities and so on.
So basically what they do is they help facilitate startup and economic development on Long Island, specifically based on faculty-initiated startups. They help them because these people are academics. They don't have any business.
Right. So it works in conjunction with the Tech Transfer Office, but what one of the things that the Center for Biotech has done in the past with our students when we've had patent eligible students to send them is they take business students and biotech PhD students and, when available, law students, and they put them together with the academic inventors to try to help them take idea to marketable product, understanding the patent issues, understanding the business issues. Students are a wonderful resource in a lot of ways. It's a great opportunity for the students. It's a great opportunity for the inventors. Some of the better ones then graduate, so to speak, to the incubators at Stony Brook, the Long Island High Technology Incubator, LIDE, which is very closely affiliated. So there's an entire process where you get academic inventors, faculty members, researchers, supported by the university, nurtured by on-campus resources, shifted into the successful ones, more of a business mode, and ultimately introduced to potential licensees, industry partners, venture capitalists. And when a university system has those pieces in place, and whether it's Stony Brook, or certainly you hear what goes on in Stanford and Silicon Valley, there's an entire infrastructure. Or David Crane, who is a serial entrepreneur, moved here a few years ago, talks about what was going on very similarly in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where there was collaboration among industry and finance and universities to try to generate economic growth overall. And so much of that is licensing. The manufacture and the distribution of what comes out of these universities is rarely, if ever, here. There is some of it, yes. But much more of it is taken from our university, and we're competing with all the other universities for the investment dollars and the licensing dollars and the manufacturer deals. And if we succeed, the money flows back here into our economy as opposed to Silicon Valley or Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Albany, or anywhere else. The schools often develop particular expertise. Yes, some universities do everything. But, for example, Albany, University of Albany, which is a SUNY school, their particular thing is nanotech. Albany has a nanotech center that is world class. They have spent, that's where they focused their research, that's where they focused their industry partnerships. They've developed this, they've brought in, I visited there, God, it's gotta be 7 or 8 years. No, it's more than that, more like 10 years ago. Not long after I came here, we were doing grant things and I was touring some of the centers. And even then, Center for Nanotechnology was phenomenal. Today, it is unbelievable.
It's so unbelievable that it's not Albany's anymore. It's private now. IBM bought it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Albany had real expertise.
Yeah.
I suspect there's probably still some academic participation.
Yeah, I think there's like...
They just don't have to pay for it.
Joining profession. Yeah,
right.
Somewhere over. They got smarter about it.
And, you know, there are... So we have among other things, we have the Center of Excellence in Wireless and Information Technology. And that brings in industry partners to come in and work with academic researchers, and there are all sorts of really challenging questions. Because sometimes you have competitors, competitor companies who are sharing the space and sharing the fruits of the research and having to parse through what's ours, what's theirs, what's shared. So these are not simple programs to set up. They're not simple programs to fund. There's a reason why there is the New York State Science and Technology Law Center, the grant I was trying to get for us years ago. It was at Albany first, Albany Law, and then, quite appropriately, beginning in August 2004, it moved to Syracuse. The State Research Foundation, formerly known as NYSTAR, or it's now just called NYSTAR, but it used to stand for something. It used to be the New York State Office of Science, Technology, and Academic Research. Now they just call it NYSTAR. But NYSTAR, back first in 1997-ish, figured out that it was creating all these funded centers. Centers of excellence and centers for advanced technology and star centers and all these things, and placing them around the state. And they all had legal questions. And so beginning in 1997, and then renewed every 3 years, they funded a law school program to help support the scientific research programs. And I really can't complain, because Syracuse has been doing tech transfer and commercialization for something like 35 years now. And they have a very strong, and in fact, Mike Bielski, who some of you may know because he's taught here, who has been the associate director at Center for Biotech, he came out of the Syracuse program. So the state is funding a law school program to provide legal understanding. Whether or not it's legal advice is a little bit fuzzy, to the state-funded research centers, because these legal issues are so complicated. New York State Science Technology Law Center advises the research center, NYSTAR, academic institutions, and other public and private stakeholders on a wide range of technology-related legal issues, including the protection and commercialization of intellectual property, tech transfer practices, patents, copyright and trademark law, and licensing agreements. So lots of law involved. So there's some really unique challenges for biotech. This isn't just the legal stuff. This isn't just the economic challenges, or the expiration of patents. Biotech brings with it some special factors, like ethics. Because many of these developments can only be developed through experiments on living things and living people, and hopefully continuing to live living people. And the balance of profit versus medical necessity. How much do you focus on making money? How much do you focus, bless you, on solving a problem, a medical problem, even if either there's no money to be made or the beneficiaries don't have enough to pay for it? What do you charge for your drug, for your treatment? Do you charge everything the market can bear, or not? What about drugs? I mean, some of you may have heard of orphan drugs. I think that's the right phrase. Mm-hmm. Where you have very rare conditions that affect a tiny population. And medical science can help them. But nobody spends the money to do it because there is no return on investment. And so those people who could be helped often have to lobby to get a little bit of research money sent their way because the for-profit organizations don't want to go into those markets. They're too small. That's fine if you're simply talking about markets, but here you're talking about lives. There are real issues in biotech for ownership because it's damned expensive to do biotechnology research and development. This is not something that your average startup company can do. It's not something that even your average major university can do on its own. A lot of times, the only body with enough money to make this happen is a government.
Yes, the numbers on that. To take a drug.
Do you want
to
just. No. Or three bitcoins.
Yeah, there you go. I think last we saw there's an entire industry, biotech industry, was really created to bridge the gap between academia or small business and large pharma. So
right, there's that intermediate stage.
Yeah, because those, it costs about 200 or 100 million to get something through phase one.
I have a friend who started up a business basically trying to, you look for the promising academic things and you look for the promising investors and producers and you try to fill that gap. It's not an easy business because as hard as it is for the big companies to predict what's going to play, they at least have some lever, they have leeway. The small companies, they can only pick one or two or three that they're going to bet on to take it through the trials to hopefully get enough success to then turn to the big companies and either sell it or jointly license. And if they bet wrong, they're out of business. So you've got government funding and what rights and what responsibilities come with that. And if government is funding, do people also get a profit? Ownership of the human sources of material, issues of timing, patents and other things. We've talked about those. How quickly things change. I'm actually going to leave off Bayh-Dole because it's a bigger topic, but I want to I'm going to come back to this. I want to share with you a story. The story of Henrietta Lacks, who 50 years ago died of cervical cancer in the, quote, colored ward at Johns Hopkins Hospital. But she happened to have unique for research cells. And there was an entire industry producing, distributing cells from Henrietta Lacks, who died getting nothing. So this was February of 2010, this story from the New York Times. There was a book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, that came out of it. I think it became a documentary. And the injustice and issues, now this was not human testing. She died of this cancer, but her cells literally lived on and had commercial value. And whether what the ownership was. So that story has moved on. This is from March of last year. The cells are codenamed Hella for Henrietta Lacks. Right. Then scientists sequenced her genome. And then they published them. And then there were questions of consent to publish it. And that was the sequel. And then in August, 62 years later, they finally came to an agreement. Johns Hopkins and the family finally came to an agreement consenting to what had already occurred. So just think about how this encapsulates the commercialization issues, the human issues, ethics, profit, notice, consent. And we'll leave that, let you think about that, and then in our next class we'll come back to the legal structure around tech transfer, commercialization, and government funding. All right, have a good night. Yes, sir. Hold on.
Friday.